Here in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the threat of cyber terrorism. And our guest for the program is Dan Vertan. He's a senior writer and veteran investigative reporter with Computer World magazine. And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in a recently published book titled Black Ice, The Invisible Threat of Cyber Terrorism. And let me just read to you a paragraph here to start us off to kind of introduce the idea. He writes in the introduction to his book, "All of the things that we take for granted in our everyday lives, such as electricity, telephone and internet service, the 911 emergency system, air traffic control systems, banks and ATM machines, credit card systems, real-time financial market transactions, waterways and railroads, hospitals and critical life-saving medical equipment, a large percentage of the Pentagon's national defense capabilities, and a host of other so-called critical infrastructures rely on computers and computer networks for their management and continued operation. And increasingly, these networks are becoming more connected and more dependent on each other, creating a situation where a failure in one network can cause cascading failures throughout many other networks. It's a system that he argues is quite vulnerable to attack, and that is what we'll be talking about here this morning. He has written thousands of stories on computer security, national defense topics for a variety of publications. He is also a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. And he's joining us by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. And the local number here, 333-9455. At any point, if you have questions, you should feel welcome to call. Mr. Vertan, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate it. Here, I guess I'd like to start this way, because you also, in the introduction, write that cyber terrorism may be one of the most misunderstood and misused terms ever to come out of the information age.
Right.
So I guess that maybe we should start with a definition. If indeed it's misunderstood, misused, what is cyber terrorism?
Well, cyber terrorism, generally speaking, most people think of cyber terrorism as somebody sitting behind a computer terminal, for example, and launching some sort of attack over the Internet. While that is true, while a cyber terrorist attack can come in that form, in other words, you can potentially manipulate the levels of chlorine in drinking water and make it toxic by hacking into a water systems network. Cyber terrorism is also a very physical phenomenon that a lot of people have not thought about. In other words, you can physically destroy, through traditional terrorist attacks, critical cyber infrastructures that power our economy or that power critical infrastructures that are key to public safety, and you can have the same sorts of impact that you would sitting behind a computer system and doing something over the Internet. So my argument is that the reason it's so misunderstood and misused is that most security experts have not thought about the physical, traditional terrorist attack and where it fits into this overall scheme of cyber terrorism.
Yeah, I think you also, as far as just the way that people think about terrorism, you say, you know, we think about terrorism, particularly big dramatic events. We think about
right.
Oklahoma City. We think about 9/11. But that we don't really think about this, or particularly the way that cyber terrorism could be paired with this more conventional kind of terrorism, and that could create a result that perhaps would be more devastating than
right.
either of those two things if they were done in isolation.
Right. And, you know, that really stems from the picture that we all have in our minds when we think of groups like Al-Qaeda. You know, the first picture that comes to our mind when we think about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda is this mindless horde of thugs who are living in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan. But we don't think about not only this smaller cadre of individuals who are very technologically advanced and sophisticated, who we know are working on behalf of Al-Qaeda. We don't think about the laptop computers that we found in those caves when we started the war on terrorism that contained detailed information on the computer networks and systems that control dams and waterways and the electric power grid in the United States. And we don't think about the young people around the world who are not only being radicalized to a certain extent by groups like Al-Qaeda, but are also being taught mathematics, computer science, and engineering. So today's threat, while to a certain extent it does look like that group of mindless thugs that are sitting in a cave in Afghanistan, the tomorrow's threat may look very different and may be capable in different ways. We need to think of it in those terms.
In the very first chapter of the book, you create a scenario. I wonder if you could give a reduced kind of sketch of a plausible, based on what we know, mm-hmm. based on the information that we have, a kind of a plausible scenario of the kind of terrorist attack that you are thinking about and you're encouraging
sure.
people to consider.
Yeah, well, let me give you an example. It's even even more recent than some of the information that I base my scenario on in my book, which is the August 14th blackout. One of the key scenarios that most government leaders are very concerned about is this combination of physical traditional terrorist attacks combined with a cyber terrorist attack. So, for example, if you were to have a cyber attack that targeted some of the key infrastructures like the electric power grid, for example, which we know have multiple avenues of approach and interconnection to the public internet, you could potentially take down electric power throughout a multi-state region, such as what we saw on August 14th, and also actually an exercise that my title of my book is based on, called Black Ice, proved is possible. You can then, from that point on, go ahead and physically target, in other words, you know, destroy through either bombing or some other method, key telecommunications facilities. So what you have now is you have this massive blackout, a loss of electric power that's not only causing economic damage, but it's also causing some chaos, fear, and confusion among the general population. And you can follow that up quickly with your traditional style terrorist attacks. So what we saw on August 14th is a perfect example where you've got people coalescing on the streets of major cities or being stuck in subway systems. They are basically sitting ducks for your traditional style terrorist attacks that everybody realizes and knows could happen here in the United States. Mm-hmm. But when you've got that cyber element thrown into the mix, where you're disrupting communications, now you've got mass casualty attacks where the government and emergency services can't necessarily respond as effectively and efficiently because they can't communicate. You've got a situation where information is not getting out. Where the cascading effect that you mentioned in the setup for this interview, where electric power ends up causing the failure in the telecom system, the telecommunications system ends up causing failures in not only government services and emergency services operations, but also in the banking system in that region, in the financial areas in that region. And we saw on August 14th, for example, that electric power also has implications for drinking water. There are, you know, waterways and wastewater treatment facilities that depend on electric power for all these operations. So you have one infrastructure failure cascading out of control, and it could come in the form of a physical attack or in a cyber disruption. So that's really the scenario that the government is most concerned about because, this whole nexus of physical traditional terrorist attacks and cyber terrorist attacks creates the very situation that terrorists would love to be able to create, which is this uncertainty, fear, and doubt that they can take advantage of.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the problem is magnified by the fact that all of these elements of infrastructure that we depend on, they're not secret. They're right out there in the open, and I'm sure have minimal security, if any.
Well, it's getting better. I mean, security is certainly getting better, but you're absolutely right that the genie is out of the bottle. One of the things that I document in Black Ice is, the amount of information that's available about our critical infrastructures that's available on the Internet. You name it, and you can find it basically on the Internet. And, you know, all of these groups, they've proven, you know, Al-Qaeda has proven that for years they've been studying these things, and we found that evidence on various laptops that we've confiscated when we not only went to Afghanistan, but also in other places around the world. So they have been actively studying and collecting intelligence on all of these things we call critical infrastructures.
Let me introduce again quickly our guest. We're talking with Dan Verton. He's a senior writer and investigative reporter with Computer World magazine. If you're interested in reading on this subject, he has a new book out that's titled Black Ice, The Invisible Threat of Cyber Terrorism. And it is published by McGraw-Hill, and it should be out there in the bookstores if you're interested in reading it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about Black Ice, the operation that the title of the book comes from.
Yeah, it's very interesting in that, you know, the scenario I just painted for you is actually a scenario that was the centerpiece of an exercise called Black Ice that took place a couple of years ago. In the Pacific Northwest region of the country, various government agencies, the private sector, and three Canadian provinces up there in the Pacific Northwest all got together and created this exercise that they codenamed Black Ice, and they used it to basically, you know, practice their response to this major sort of terrorist attack that combined physical attacks with cyber attacks. And the results were really startling and very scary because the scenario was not only based around at that time the Winter Olympics were taking place in Salt Lake City, so they wanted to be prepared for any major sort of attacks that took place when thousands and thousands of people were flowing into the region. But they also asked the actual owners and operators of all of these private infrastructures, which is another key point, by the way, that, you know, all these things we're talking about are not defended by the government. They're owned and operated and defended by private companies, which is, you know, another issue that needs to be dealt with. But they asked all these private companies to come in and give them their worst-case scenarios, their worst fears in terms of security, and they built a scenario for the exercise around those worst fears. And the results were that a five-state region in the Pacific Northwest of the country, including three Canadian provinces, lost electric power for several months. Due to a combined physical and cyber terrorist attack on critical infrastructures. Telecommunications failed, the internet failed, emergency services were hampered significantly. And the end result was that they showed that all of these various private companies that owned the electric power grids, that owned the waterways, natural gas system, telecommunications facilities, all of these companies, they demonstrated at best a surface-level understanding of how they depended on other infrastructures and how other infrastructures depended on their companies and their facilities. And so, you know, the lesson, the bottom line lesson is that they really didn't quite understand how to get all of these infrastructures back up and running at the same time. And, you know, whenever you have a power outage that lasts more than a month, and in some cases we were looking at several months outage, you've got mass chaos in some major urban areas. You've got companies that will not recover. They will go out of business for good. And you have massive, massive economic damage. So that's just one example of how you know, bad it can get.
I suppose some people would say that kind of scenario would ask this question, given the fact that to do that, you would have to have a terrorist organization that was reasonably good size, that had that level of technical expertise, that was very well organized. And as far as the terrorists are concerned, when they were carrying out what it is they wanted to do, that everything would have to go the way they expect and the way they would want. How likely, what is the probability of actually all of that coming together to result in, as again, as far as the terrorists are concerned, a successful attack of that magnitude?
Well, again, you're absolutely right that there's this whole, you know, equation that has to be met, and that is, you know, in terms of intent and capability have to be there. And also we're talking about a situation where probably individuals have to be here present in the United States. But the key point is here is when you combine a physical and cyber terrorist attack is that you only have to have a small portion of the infrastructure, terrorist infrastructure here in the United States to carry out the physical portion. The cyber portion can be carried out from anywhere on the globe. And so that's a key point to keep in mind. And the reason that that's so important is because, you know, Al-Qaeda, while it would be very difficult for anybody to go and claim that they could find a sophisticated Al-Qaeda hacker within the ranks of Al-Qaeda, although they are there and I document that, Al-Qaeda also has various support infrastructures all over the globe where this type of capability is present, in out-of-work Russian nuclear scientists, out-of-work Russian intelligence agents, in Malaysia, where there's a major upswing in cybercrime and support for groups like Al-Qaeda, and in various other areas, such as the Pakistani intelligence services. So they can actually go out and hire this talent to do some of the work for them. But, you know, getting the terrorists here in the United States is probably not the difficult part, as everybody has learned through the recent news on border control and airline security, but, you know, they're probably already here. So, you know, that's really not the showstopper for them. You know, they only have to have a few cells, you know, one or two cells that are able to identify the proper key facilities and nodes that they can attack physically, and the rest can be done through cyber means, and, you know, there you have this combined cocktail, if you will.
One of the things that you mentioned a couple of moments ago, why this is a difficult thing to deal with, is that there are kind of two levels you got to work on. There's the level of the federal government, but there's also the level of private industry, and because
right.
so much of this infrastructure is owned by private companies that either want to maintain a certain kind of openness, or in the way that they do business, that's important for them to have a certain kind of openness.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, obviously, there's a bottom line that they have to consider. Security can be expensive, and they're going to try to figure out what's the way that they can do the best to meet the need, but do it with spending the least amount of money.
Right.
Do you think that is the case that private business is not taking the possibility of this kind of attack seriously enough?
They were. Right after 9/11, like everybody else, they were taking it seriously. Unfortunately, we seem to have a very short memory span in this country, and right now, I've actually had people comment to me that September 11th seems so far in the past. And so there's been this sort of backing off of security. It's quite disturbing for me. I don't know why we would, just over 2 years now down the road, and we're still, thinking that the threat is gone. It no longer exists. But you're absolutely right. This is unprecedented in American history that such key facilities and infrastructures that we depend on not only for our economic viability, but for public safety applications as well, are in the hands of private companies. And the government can no longer defend us on their own from these sorts of attacks. And you're absolutely right when you say the private sector has some financial concerns in terms of deciding how much they can afford to protect against. But they're also very much, they've been very much lobbying the government over the last several years to, take a hands-off approach. In other words, not to enforce any sort of regulatory controls over the private sector to force security on them, because you're right, they want to be able to do business in new ways and use the technology that's available. And because they don't see an imminent threat, because they don't necessarily see a massive sort of attack coming, they think that they can get away with it, and they're not investing the money, and they're succeeding in lobbying the government to not impose any new regulations. And unfortunately, the general consensus is that it's going to take another major event of some sort, maybe not on the scale of 9/11, but certainly from an economic perspective, maybe something approaching that, a very devastating sort of series of events that will force some sort of legislation or regulation on the private sector. And that's the dangerous part, because they're not doing anything proactively, they may end up being forced to accept some regulations that they don't necessarily like. And it might be better for them to go ahead and take the lead and be proactive in this sense rather than wait for something to happen. And unfortunately, I think it's going to be the latter. They're going to wait for something to happen. So,
well, we're going to take we're going to do something here that the 50 weeks out of the year that we do the show, we never do. We're going to take a short break, and I hope, Dan, you wouldn't mind holding on for just a second.
Sure.
Because we're here coming near the end of our fall fundraising week. And it's really important. We want to just mention to folks once again just how important their financial support is to the station. If we're going to make the goal that we've set for ourselves for just this week, $150,000, we need to have a big finish to the week. So I'd like to remind you again that we have folks waiting to take that call. If you're not a financial supporter of the station, it's very, very important, because over time, the money, the tax-based sources of funding have continued to erode, and we expect that that's just the way it's going to be in the future, and that we're thinking about a different way of approaching this whole matter of funding public broadcasting, relying to a greater and greater degree on listeners. 244-9455 is the number to call to make a pledge. If you haven't, we hope that you will do that. And we talk all the time about challenges. We have a couple going this morning, and I think we have even a new one. Sometimes it gets a little confusing. We'll see if we can make it as clear as possible. Jack Brighton, former producer, occasional host on the show, is here in studio with me. And I think also joining us in Pledge Central is Dave Teal. He is the program director for WILL-TV.
Right. There's been a flurry of activity this morning, David. I think people are realizing, oh, it's Friday. I haven't called yet. I've been meaning to do that all week. So now is the last day that we'll be talking to you on Focus 580 about supporting the show, the station, the service, etc. So don't wait. Don't miss out. Get in on the flurry of action by making your pledge call. 217 is the area code, 244-9455. And David Teal, we do have, I guess, three challenges going right now, and I think two of those are very, very close to being met. Where do we stand?
Yeah, indeed. We have we had a challenge we've been working on all morning from a couple in Champaign who will add $250 to our pledge total when we hear from 100 pledges by noon. There was a second challenge from another couple in Champaign that was adding $10 to every pledge this morning. Again, up until noon, up to a total of $1,000. Now, we're about, I believe, six calls away. Yeah,
wow.
Six calls away from retiring those. But we have a new one, and this is specifically for Focus. This is another Champaign couple. Champaign's very good to us, who are loyal Focus listeners and believe so strongly in the variety of topics that Focus brings them each week. They will add $250 to their annual contribution when we hear from 25 more callers. So right now, the next half a dozen callers or so will help us to meet three different challenges, and you realize it adds about $25. To each pledge that comes in because of all the combination of these challenges.
Right. So if you haven't done it yet, folks, you know it's a good show. You listen to the show. It's an important program that we do here. We've invested a lot of effort into it over the years. We've been doing the show for 22 years or something like that. And in fact, we're talking about cyber terrorism this morning. Not a pleasant topic, but you know what? It's really important. And we've been covering this issue actually way before 9/11, we were covering issues relating to international security, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, Iraq. We were talking about Afghanistan, talking about Islam, talking about the United States foreign policy. All these issues we've been covering in depth for years, and it's the kind of show where we can really do a good job of doing that and get you the perspective that you need to understand what's going on. So if this is the kind of thing that you think ought to be on the air, then help keep us on the air with your pledge call, 217-244-9455.
All right, thank you very much, Dave and Jack, and we will talk a little bit more at the end of the program. I'd like to introduce again our guest for this hour, Dan Verton. He's a senior writer and veteran investigative reporter with Computer World magazine in Washington, D.C., and has written many stories on computer security and national defense topics and national security. He's also a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps and is the author of a recently published book exploring this issue that we're talking about here this morning. So if you would like to read more, you can look for the book. It's titled Black Ice, The Invisible Threat of Cyber Terrorism. And the publisher on this book is Osborne, which is an imprint of McGraw-Hill. I'm sure if you just go out there to the bookstore and look for Black Ice, you will be able to find it. Questions on this program, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that happened, I think, right after 9/11 was there was a great concern voiced about how much information about infrastructure was easily available in the public domain. and through the internet. So right after that, there started to be a number of restrictions put in place. Information that was available before suddenly now was not.
Right.
And there was a lot of concern voiced by people who are worried about the issue of free exchange of information. Journalists were concerned. I think scientists and researchers were concerned. And the overall question was raised is, well, is it possible that we'll go too far in the direction of restricting information and not have the kind of free exchange of information that we think is important and have become used to? And I guess that's the big question is, where do you draw that line between having something be classified and closed and
right.
having something to be easily available?
Well, you know, sometimes it's not as difficult as you might think. Let me give you some examples that I outline in the book that really are kind of no-brainers as far as I can tell. But right after 9/11, as you said, there was this massive scrub of websites all over the country to determine whether or not we were giving the people who were trying to kill us a little too much information to help them in that effort. And one of my sources is a former CIA psychological profiler who now works for a security firm in Manhattan. And some of the largest firms in Manhattan came to him and asked him to perform basically a scrub of their websites to find out to what extent the information that was available made them targets of Al-Qaeda. And some of the information he found was just mind-blowing. He found, for example, the load-bearing capacities of elevators in major office buildings in Manhattan. He found the locations in maps and things of other nature of all air conditioning ventilation systems for major office buildings. So you can imagine somebody who might have been planning an anthrax sort of attack of some sort being able to find the location of the air conditioning vents and stuff like that. He found the numbers of people working in any one building at any given time. He found banking facilities that advertised basically the Al-Qaeda bank accounts that they had frozen on behalf of the U.S. government that was available on the Internet. And he also found websites that had basically support for issues such as globalization, which we know from past experience has been an issue that has motivated certain portions of the Al-Qaeda network to target individuals for attack. So there was a lot of information that had absolutely no business value to the businesses that were posting it that was available online. And it really did nothing but make them more of an easy, soft target, if you will. Now, you're absolutely right that there's this balance that has to be struck because there is certain information that the public has a right to know and a need to know. For example, one of the things that I document is the interactive maps of all of the locations for spent nuclear fuel in the United States. And I found these maps on the Internet that were published by the Department of Energy. And the argument goes that obviously neighborhoods and communities around the country have a right to know where sensitive sort of facilities are located, such as chemical processing facilities and these nuclear waste storage facilities, because they want to know. People want to know that, you know, if their children are in danger or if their communities and drinking water are in danger. So they have a right to know that information. But by posting this on the Internet for so many years, we now are providing this sort of this tool for our enemies around the world that would make it that much easier for them to find this material or to target this material. So on the one hand, we do need to have the information out there. On the other hand, we need to, ensure that we're not giving too much detail that would enable somebody who's trying to do us harm to use it as an attack tool.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And the listener is in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. And I have four comments. One is, I haven't read the book, by the way. I'm a 67-year-old woman with three boys. And my question is, how can we help in a personal way? We have all kinds of challenges, personal and professional, and that's my question. How can we help in a practical way? I'll hang up and listen to your guest.
All right. Well, I think that that's an excellent question. We've talked about what we might do on the level of government, and we've talked about what might be done on the level of private business. But the listener raises this question, well, is there something that an individual citizen can do or should do?
That's really a great question. And, in fact, it's a question that is really not getting enough attention, in my opinion. One of the things that the average person can do is when he or she goes and buys a new computer for home use, for example, and they move to these things such as cable modems and broadband DSL connections that help them surf the web faster, these are systems that become targets of people who are trying to do more malicious things to other portions of the Internet because they're not protected. So they become targets where an attacker can take over that computer and use that computer to attack other portions of the infrastructure rather than going directly to them. And one of the reasons they do that is because they're able to hide their tracks. They're able to conceal their tracks on the Internet. And, you know, guess who the FBI comes looking for when they finally do the first search of, you know, where the attack came from? They go to the computer owner where the attack seems to have come from, but meanwhile it's really coming from somebody who's sitting in another country somewhere. So one of the key things that home users can do in a very practical sense is to ensure that they have the proper security software, the proper antivirus software, and maybe even a personal firewall device that prevents their computer from being broken into and used to attack other computers.
And that's just, I think, that's the kind of continual advice that people get if they're using the Internet, just if terrorism aside, because
right.
there are viruses out there, there are people who are interested in hacking, there's all sorts of issues like that, and it just seems to be common sense that you should have some kind of protection
right.
if you're going to be on the Internet.
My point is that everybody is somebody else's weakest link. Because we're all interconnected, we're all using the same infrastructure, and if I don't take the proper steps to make sure my computer's secure, somebody potentially could come and use my computer to attack somebody else, and at that point, I'm just part of the problem.
I think we certainly know that even before September 11th, there were people who were trying to wave the red flag and say, look, we're vulnerable to various kinds of attack. We should think about this. It's a problem. So then when September 11th came, everybody was shocked. Some people were shocked. And then we started thinking seriously about those issues. Then as time, as you say, someone you knew said, gosh, it seems like such a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Interest, it initially peaked. It was everything anybody could think about or talk about. Then you got to kind of get back to your life. And so the interest sort of trailed off. This is the issue of cyber terrorism is something that has been on the, you know, on the agenda. It's been discussed for some time. I guess I wonder to what extent on the federal government level people are actually addressing this and thinking seriously about it and perhaps going beyond just talking about it.
Well, they're trying to do quite a lot, fortunately. Here's where the problem comes in. You know, one of my good sources for this book was Richard Clark, who is the former presidential advisor for cybersecurity and the nation's first, basically, cybersecurity czar. He was also the former national coordinator for counterterrorism. So he was there throughout three administrations. He just left earlier this year, left government service. But when he left, a lot of other individuals left, and so went a lot of corporate knowledge, if you will, and experience, and a lot of credibility. Now we've got a whole crop of new individuals who are taking over the cybersecurity division at the Department of Homeland Security, new blood, not necessarily tested or trusted by the private sector, which we just determined owns and operates all these things we're trying to protect. So I think the jury is still out as to what they can or will try to do. You know, right now they are trying to form this partnership between the government and the private companies that own the things that we depend upon for our day-to-day lives. And they're trying to ensure that proper information is shared on incidents and on pending incidents, things that are indications and warning sorts of things that we missed prior to 9/11. So they're trying to form those partnerships, but there is still this very high level of distrust between the private sector and the government. The private companies that we're talking about are very nervous that the information they share on proprietary data from their companies will not be protected by the government from inadvertent disclosure. So they're very much nervous that some of their trade secrets might end up getting out to competitors and others around the world. And so there's this hesitancy, there's a reluctance to share the proper information with the government. And this is where this challenge I mentioned earlier comes in, where, all right, do we have to regulate this? Do we have to legislate it, force them to do it? Or do we continue with this, you know, sort of ad hoc voluntary structure we've got in place? So there's movement. We just don't know if it's going to move fast enough before the next incident occurs.
You mentioned that one of your important sources for the book was Richard Clark, who was the former chairman of the President's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board, senior advisor for cybersecurity. He's the cyber czar. Is there someone in that position now? Who is the current cyber czar?
Well,
is there one?
It's hard to say. There is nobody like Richard Clark in the current administration, because Richard Clark was a senior member of the National Security Council who had the direct ear of the president. There is no longer somebody other than Tom Ridge who's got the direct line, got a direct line to the president. And this is where the problem comes in. When Richard Clark left, and my sources tell me he left for a number of reasons, one of which was that he saw his position in the cybersecurity critical infrastructure protection arena being watered down. And that's exactly what has happened. They have an individual who is now responsible for cybersecurity throughout both the government and the private sector that is at least 4 to 5 levels beneath Tom Ridge in this overall new Department of Homeland Security. That is very much, way out of the ballpark in terms of getting information to the president. It's like playing a game of telephone. You know, who knows whether his advice, and this is an individual who really knows what he's doing. His name is Amit Yoran. He's a former executive for Symantec Corporation. He really understands the issues, but there's this big question hanging over everybody's head whether or not he will be able to get the right information to the people who make the decisions, because he's so far down in the structure. So therein lies the challenge. There's nobody covering cybersecurity critical infrastructure protection that has a direct ear of the president other than Tom Ridge. And Tom Ridge, quite frankly, is just too senior to really understand all the details of this issue.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. Dan Vertan is our guest. He's a senior writer for Computer World magazine, authored a book, Black Ice, Invisible Threat of Cyber Terrorism. If someone wanted to call real quick here, if you have a question, we'll get you in, but don't wait until the very end of the program. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that we are aware that terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda are interested in exploiting this possibility. And also, we're told periodically when the question of Homeland Security is raised, we're told by the government, says, well, you know, we're doing things that you don't hear about. And occasionally you hear news about a thwarted potential attack. Do we know, in fact, that people have attempted things like cyber terrorism and that they've been caught before they could actually do it?
Well, we certainly know that there have been incidents that, if they had been successful, may have risen to the level of cyber terrorism. For example, we know that there have been incidents of juveniles who have been able to hack into air traffic control systems, have been able to knock out power to critical air traffic control facilities, who have been able to overload emergency 911 systems using the Internet so that important emergency calls couldn't get through. And we also know that recently a group of individuals, hacked into the California power grid for 12 days undetected. And we don't know if they were juveniles who didn't quite understand what they had gotten into, or if they were more sophisticated individuals who were doing some sort of reconnaissance or intelligence gathering. But they were there for, 12 days undetected, and there's an example of how they could have made a very already bad situation out in California in terms of the stability of the power grid much worse. So we do know that that's happening. And one last point that I'd like to make is that If we learn anything from this, let's go away from this discussion understanding that there have been, and this is something I document, individuals within Al-Qaeda who have been sent to electronics training at guest houses owned by Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. And they have been turned away from this electronics training because they did not have degrees in engineering. So here's an organization that we think of as this mindless horde of thugs who is turning away their own members from electronics training because they're not degreed engineers. So this is a very technologically sophisticated organization that we underestimate at our own peril.
We have just a couple of minutes. We have two calls. We'll try to get at least one, if not two. Urbana first, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that people like people out of certain organizations like globalsecurity.org, iDefense, I'm reading here, vmyths.com, they all poo-poo what you're saying. Marcus Rainham, who watched over networks for the White House, even went so far as to say it wouldn't be until 20 years before cyber warfare could pose a substantial danger. And that was kind of alluded to earlier in this conversation. I just wanted to put some names to it. But I had a question. Since there are plenty of organizations who are against the government on many different policies, including environmental groups, racist groups, extremist political groups, wouldn't we see homegrown attacks long before we'd see these foreign-based attacks?
Absolutely. That's a great question too. In the opening fictional scenario that I give in my book, I actually include a portion of this attack I attribute to a homegrown organization that, as you mentioned, is certainly just as much against our government as other international terrorist groups. So the one thing they would have that Al-Qaeda might not have is insider access to key facilities and key systems that control things like the power grid and other things. So you're absolutely right. That is certainly a possibility, and very few energy companies these days do detailed background investigations of their employees who have access to these key facilities and infrastructures. So that's definitely a possibility. And one quick note that I'll say regarding some of the folks who have, as you say, poo-pooed this whole notion is that my whole point is that we need to think differently after 9/11. One of the things that we missed prior to 9/11 was the fact that Al-Qaeda was for 8 years prior to that trying to use commercial airliners as precision strike weapons, and we, for some reason, were surprised on 9/11. My point is, let's not do that in the cyber realm at this point.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop there. I'm sure that we can get back to the subject, and we'll get back to the subject in the future. But for right now, we need to leave it. First of all, with our thanks to Dan Vertin. He's a senior writer, veteran, investigative reporter with Computer World magazine in Washington, D.C., and author of the book Black Ice, The Invisible Threat of Cyber Terrorism, published by Osborne, which is a division of McGraw-Hill. Mr. Vertin, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you very much for having me.